The way debt works is you're effectively borrowing from the future, right? Money competes like any other technology. Better systems eventually replace weaker ones. And if you remember Gresham's law, of course, good money always sucks in bad money. Bad money runs away towards good money. And this is what you're experiencing when you see the prices of, things at a shop go up. It's not that those things became more valuable, more expensive. It's that your money lost value. And if you've kept money in your pocket, you know, let's say that you keep £100 in your pocket over a year, if inflation is at 4%, by the end of that year, that £100 can only buy you an equivalent of £96, right? Hello and welcome to WS Podcast. My name is Wojciech Salski, I'll be your host for today. And before we begin, may I just remind you, if you haven't already, please do me a big one and make sure to click that subscribe or like button, whichever platform you're using. It helps the podcast to grow. It lets me know that one episode is better than the other, and I can track essentially where from, why potentially are you listening, what kind of a listener you are, and hopefully you can kind of make a vote for the kind of show you'd like to see here. So I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to the episode with Nick about the Fountain platform on which my show is now hosted. I'll make sure to make a proper introductory sort of trailer in the coming probably weeks, maybe months, depending on my availability. But for the most part, you know, to make the podcast to grow, I need you. Like, that's it. I can only do so much with social media, and there is nothing better than a word of mouth advertising. So yeah, if you do think this is valuable, please make sure to follow, subscribe, whatever. Maybe share it with a friend. If you'd like to support the podcast in any other way, maybe by sending me some sats or literally sending me an email, follow the link below. There are many of options to choose from. Other than that, enjoy the show. Today, we will, and I'll pull it up on my screen as well as my notes here on the bottom. Today, we will be discussing Lynn Alden's book, Broken Money. Essentially, it's this crazy, crazy one, a big one, a big boy. And this probably is the most difficult book in this season for you. So if you have been following the podcast over the past months, we've done, I'm pretty sure, 8 or maybe 7 episodes so far with books ranging, you know, across the spectrum of financial literacy, economy, and so forth. Stuff related to that we've also explored on one of the on some of the interviews I've done recently, and I would like to say that this is a book for everyone, and it is, but I am aware that some of you, if you are not willing to take the chance with such a big Bible-sized book, in many ways, it might just not be the one you pick up first. So I hope to give you 3 key ideas from Lynn Alden's work. And hopefully, by the end of this episode, if you were not to pick up the book afterwards, at least you get the gist and you can act on it. And whether or not you'd like to explore the book later, I'll give you the link below, of course, to do so. And I would encourage you to do so. It was a challenge for me to go through it, especially that some of the parts were quite technical. but it's a must read, I must say. I do believe, you know, if you want to comprehend fully the tricks of the financial system in which we live in, and if you want to tackle it, Lynn's work is probably one of the best in terms of comprehensive study and exploration of how money emerged, what money is, why is it constantly changing really, and where can we go from here. And of course, if you are not familiar with Lynn Alden and her work, then, you know, there's plenty for you to explore. So maybe also, and I'll take a note for you of that, I'll actually link one of my favorite conversations I've heard of Lynn with one of the podcasters out there. Maybe at some point I'll have her on mine. Who knows? But yeah, so here we are. Yeah, let's have a start, right? Shall we? So maybe you've heard this quote, maybe you haven't. It's a quote that by now is very familiar to me, but you know, as I've been exposed to these ideas for quite some time now. There is a quote from Lynn, which became sort of a meme. Nothing stops this train, right? Essentially, the idea is that monetary expansion, so the expanding money supply, is structural. It's not optional. So we're gonna maybe approach these to understand why is it a problem for us. But let's start with this one. In her work, the author breaks down at some point early in the book the system of monetary, you know, let's say the monetary system in which we live in right now, the fractional reserve banking, or sometimes it's called the debt-based system or credit and debt, you know, each to their own in terms of deciding the titles and stuff. But for the most part, the author argues that basically if a system is built on debt, it must keep growing unless it breaks. There are two outcomes here. You can either continue to kick the can down the road, as they say, or you can stop credit expansion, but of course that basically means that you allow defaults to happen. So let's maybe approach it from this way. And if you have had a chance to hear any of the previous episodes, then well done, because you're probably much better prepared to what I'm gonna try to discuss here. So the way debt works is you're effectively borrowing from the future, right? Like if you take something on credit, if you were to buy yourself a car on credit, effectively what you're saying is you're making a claim, you're agreeing that your future self, with your efforts into the future, will pay for however much of this car's value you cannot cover right now, right? So if you get in debt, it's not that you here today are in debt and tomorrow you're okay. It's that it's you here today consuming, or, you know, maybe investing via debt. You take from the future self, and the future self will have to pay it back at some point. And of course, that's when where the interest comes in. Effectively, interest is a price you pay for obtaining, or the price someone else pays to you for lending the money right now. And if you remember from our episode on praxeology, with Knut Svanholm's work, by definition, we are, not maybe by definition, but as one of the axioms, we ultimately value things today more than tomorrow. Of course, the decision there is the time preference. So if you have high time preference, as you might remember, you're effectively valuing things today more than tomorrow. But you can, and this is the basic survival state, let's say, but we can, because of our ability to plan into the future and to sort of to anticipate the future, we can also lower our time preference, effectively maybe saving some of our resources or maybe investing some of our time into something that will bring us value later. And then in that situation, we effectively value tomorrow more than today. And the problem here with debt and a system built on debt is once you've taken that on, unless you decide to pay it off fully, you will effectively have to take more debt on to pay some of it back into the future, especially if what you're doing is not productive. And this is a huge chunk of your understanding in terms of the monetary system in which we live right now. Effectively, those that issue money are not producing anything. They are issuing money. They are making it sort of out of thin air, really. Just printing is a good way to put it, although nowadays it's even easier than that. You don't even have to print. You just click, you know, enter and maybe enter a few more zeros on your account. And because there is no productive activity taking part in that, and yet the debt is still there to be paid with interest on top of it, and what the author argues is that it is a part of the structure that the monetary expansion is anticipating. At some point, they will have to print to cover the previous expenses. And, you know, remember the other side of it is, if, of course, credit were to stop expanding, debt will become harder to service. Effectively, there won't be anything to pay it back with. And then once any of the participants in this scheme defaults, meaning they can no longer pay their debt to whichever other participant, that other participant will also have to default. And so the system destabilize, what a word, destabilize, and effectively, it might cascade into defaults all around, right? So the central banks are effectively forced to perpetually intervene by lowering interest rates, making interest more accessible, making lending more accessible to people and borrowing. And they have to keep expanding this money supply to continue with money creation, to create liquidity, to pay off the debt from the past. And this is the train, you know, not being able to be stopped. And now you might ask, like, does that mean inflation is a bug or a feature? And of course, if you have already been with my podcast for quite some time, you understand that inflation is essential to it. It is effectively the way for the participants of this scheme to be able to continuously take away from those that are keeping value in the money that is being printed and suck it up into this non-productive, very destructive, essentially, scheme. And yeah, this is just something for you to ponder to begin with. If you haven't already, you know, explored this, please do. If you think that there is a way out, and I've recently had a discussion with my colleague here, maybe by the time you see this episode, the episode already aired with Ronan, I don't know. Basically, we've been discussing whether or not politicians and the government can change the course of inflationary policies that are effectively being put in place again and again. And according to the author, with whom I agree on this point, it doesn't seem like there is any way out other than defaulting. Because if the structure of this scheme expects of us and relies on us issuing more debt to cover the previous debt and to service all the borrowed money across the economy effectively, then where is the way out? And why would any politician risk their public office by introducing, an austerity policy, which effectively, as hard as and as needed it may be, it's not the most popular, right? No one wants to hear that they won't be provided the welfare checks that they might be relying upon, or none of the participants that rely on this expansion of money is gonna cheer on a politician who decides to stop effectively this train, or at least to slow it down. And of course one can discuss whether or not slowing it down will help. It's still, if something is collapsing and you're only slowing down the collapse, is that any better than, in some ways it is better than fast collapse, but maybe some could argue that it's actually worse, because you're prolonging the inevitable rather than getting it done and over with. It's up to you, whether you want to suffer quickly now with a big bang and reset, or would you prefer to continue down this path for longer? And of course, for us, private individuals, people that, I don't know about you, but I don't really feel I have that much agency in terms of the grander market movements, there are ways to secure ourselves while we're observing this train crash in slow motion, right? That's what usually the Bitcoiners out there who are familiar with nothing stops this train idea are calling on. Now, before we go into any practical steps, let's talk about the second theme that I wanted to discuss with you today, which is effectively what I said earlier, this idea that money is actually a technology that evolves. It is not just policy, which, I don't know if you thought, what is money? I would like you to think what money is. And I don't mean simply to look at your banknote and be like, oh, okay, money is a paper or plastic little sheet that, or maybe a number on my account. Think more deeply about it, like ponder this fact. This is something that we've been alluding to over the past season, and there are many, many shows and many sources to explore what money is. But the key idea here is that money isn't static. It evolves like any other technology, and it's always shaped by efficiency, trust, and the constraints that are put in place. Now, picture this. If it's a technology is a tool that allows us to do something, right? It allows us to interact with this world in which we live in, and the technology of money was effectively created, if you remember, to make sure that our exchanges between random participants in the market are more easily facilitated. Because back in the you know, in the old age, as they say, when there was a barter system in place. And of course, maybe you have witnessed a barter system of a sort, maybe at your school, maybe between your siblings, maybe in your local small community. You know, something that comes into mind for me is, I remember when I was young, we would exchange with my friends some little toys that were collectibles, effectively. And because there was no spreadsheet of what is worth what, barter had to be, effectively the only way out, right? We didn't price these items in dollars, pounds, zlotys. We just agreed on the spot who gives whom what and what amount. So, for example, let's say that there were a good example here would be collectible cards. I don't know if you've seen, you know, whether Pokemon cards back in the day or some Yu-Gi-Oh! Magic cards. There were some football cards as well, baseball cards, of course. So you would simply go to the other person and maybe I had two of the same kind and I'd like to have a different one. I would offer him the card, but then maybe he would say, yeah, but this card is actually quite rare, so could you give me two cards for one, right? And we would barter, we would come to an agreement and we would make the transaction. What money in that situation was simply the cards. That's all. There was no additional technology in place to facilitate that. So that's like the most maybe basic form of money between me and my friends at primary school. Now, let's say that we do introduce an additional technology, which we would call effectively money per se. Let's say that we would price each of these items in, I don't know, stones, because we had really pretty red stones outside our school and there was only so much of it, and we valued stones as a means of exchange and a store of value, whatever. In that situation, barter would not have to be necessary again. I would simply go to my friend and say, here is 10 stones for your card. Thank you very much. And then they can use those 10 stones to get another card from someone else. The way Lynn Alden puts it is, money is a ledger of human time and energy. And this is like out there in terms of your perspective on it. But if you think about it deeply, you'll comprehend it. Because all that we have in our... If you strip all the aspects of our life, there are two things that you have scarce, you have limited amount of: time and energy, right? Every day there is only so much energy you can exert before you need to go to sleep again. Every day you have only so much time before you go to sleep again. And over a lifetime, you have only so much time. And over a lifetime, you have only so much energy. Of course, you can do different things to make your energy more efficient or maybe generate more energy via some different ways of being. But for the most part, I've heard recently that all animals, including humans on this planet, have a limited number of heartbeats, and apparently an elephant has an equivalent number of heartbeats like a mouse. They just beat at different frequency and at different strength, but for the most part we apparently have a limited amount of that time energy to spend. And if you consider money to be a way of storing your time and your energy, maybe because you've gone to work, you've made money by giving up your time and some energy, and then the person who pays you, they pay you And then, you know, for you to go get shopping, you no longer have to go to work again to make money to go to the shop. You already have that energy and time stored in money, and you just simply go to the shop and buy some groceries. You know, so let me bring up a few transitions here that the author puts across in her book. We've gone from rhinestones to gold to paper banknotes, effectively, to digital, typing notes, and then potentially the next stage of this information technology transition would be a cryptocurrency. And, according to the authors, effectively, what we've done, retrospectively looking, each type of money, each kind of money was used to solve a certain problem. Maybe initially it was due to portability. You know, you had stones stuck on one another in the middle of the village, and as long as you were in that village, you could use that as a means of payment, and everyone knew there was a ledger. It's quite an abstract concept, but it is true. Look it up. Those stones were never moved, but they were a ledger of who owns, you know, which part of the village and so forth. Of course, that's not really portable. Good luck trying to take a boulder across the continent to pay for something else. So then maybe gold was introduced. Gold, of course, was still quite heavy. It is not the easiest to transport, but it was much more divisible. You can simply melt it, make it into smaller pieces, and it was much easier to transport than a big stone. Now, the problem with gold was that it was still quite heavy, so still portability was not the easiest. Of course, it was much easier to confiscate than a paper note. And so at some point, initially, what's their name? I don't remember. Well, whoever the guys who initially hoarded gold for others, and they would just issue little payments every now and then when people wanted to deposit gold in their vaults. Effectively, that became the bank. And then over time, bankers figured out a way, which we've explored in our recent episode. Some of them, I'm getting mixed up at this point. But please look through the recent seven episodes for all these ideas. Bankers came up with an idea that, instead of transporting that gold, I'll just give you a bank note, which will tell the person to whom you're going to pay where the gold is stored, and then they can always come and get it. And then, of course, banks would transact between one another. Then digital was introduced into the system, making it even quicker with the telegram and then the radio and the internet. So it became more and more easily portable and so forth. So there are different problems that each item that used to be money or potentially could be money as technology was used. But for the most part, it's always about those trade-offs. And, maybe your item is very portable, but maybe because it's so portable, it's actually easy to be lost. And maybe your item can be very divisible, but if it's very divisible, it might be difficult to account for it. Maybe something is very easily verifiable, but then at the same time, it can become a problem with being too sort of surveillance prone, right? Because everyone sees it at all the time, and so there's not much privacy. Now, the idea here effectively is that money competes like any other technology. Better systems eventually replace weaker ones, and if you remember Gresham's law, of course, good money always sucks in bad money. Bad money runs away towards good money. So, you know, maybe a good example of a shift in that better systems here is that trust shifts from physical scarcity into institutional credibility into cryptographic proof. So there came a point, as I said, when it was very risky to travel with gold on the roads. So then the credibility of the bank became a big thing that people used as part of solving that problem. Now, potentially with Bitcoin, for example, we might have a cryptographic proof to see who has what. And so you don't have to be trusting the institution that they hold your stash. You can just check. So, of course, you know, this might go a long way. We don't know what the future holds. Lynn Alden, I'm pretty sure she would agree that from my understanding of her perspective, Bitcoin is a natural progression to this, you know, to this money as technology developments. Who knows? We don't know what the future holds, as I said, but let's see, right? Would Bitcoin fit this new world? Some would say yes. You know, if you haven't already, I'll put the link below to the episode that basically breaks down for you effectively what Bitcoin can offer in this realm. And I would encourage you to educate yourself on the matter and decide for yourself. You might have quite an interesting conversation with your friends once you get to know it a little bit, simply because, if nothing else, it will allow you to understand more this idea what money really is, right? I was quite, this is maybe a little, you know, on the side, but I was quite dumbfounded recently to hear from one of my friends who are not that young that they didn't know you could buy gold. Like, they didn't know you could physically buy gold. They didn't know it was a thing. Like, they thought people trade gold on stock exchange, but when I mentioned that you could literally go to the store and buy yourself some gold coin or silver coin, they were quite dumbfounded. And so I was perplexed as well, because for me, it's something quite obvious by now. But you see, this is the thing, right? We don't know what we don't know. And so it's very, very beneficial to read even as challenging books as this one, to explore and understand these ideas in more depth and educate yourself, right? Like, it is a part of your security, and I'll keep that to the end. Now, the third theme that I'd like to explore with you today is this idea of a hidden cost of monetary debasement. And, you know, this is something that we've explored with Paul on our recent conversation, and his book Capital Offense goes in quite in depth with that idea, similarly to Lynn Alden, that inflation and currency debasement don't affect everyone equally, right? They empower this redistribution of wealth and the K-shaped economy. If you haven't heard this before, for some time I was quite, you know, ignorant about what does that mean, a K-shaped economy. Basically, a K-shaped economy is like if you flip it on its back and you have the K-shaped economy, that there is a big major group of people in the economy that have nothing or little to none, and then there is a small group of people on the very end that have a lot. And of course, you know, the distribution may vary, but for the most part, it's the minority that benefits from this system. And this is yet again something for us to really, really fully, deeply understand. And this is not an easy topic. And I know I might, you know, frustrate some of you by trying to explore this, but as we've explored recently in the praxeology episode, which I'll make sure to link below, capitalism is not the problem. Not at all. Like, you're a capitalist whenever you save resources, whenever you keep some money on the side, you keep some capital to use. Capital is all of that energy stored that you might want to engage with the world with. So the problem isn't free market economy. The problem is the fact that the market isn't free to begin with. And please dive deeper into the episode with Knut Svanholm to understand that. And secondly, the inflation is the major problem, right? And we'll explore now why. So the quote, of course, very simple. I like how concise and simple some of the quality quotes from Lin are. Currency debasement is a subtle form of taxation. So this is a very subtle way to put it. If you haven't already, then you will at some point, diving down this rabbit hole, you will hear that taxation is effectively theft. Let's not go into that. Maybe let's leave it for praxeology episode to explore that. But inflation is effectively taxation you simply don't see, right? And basically, what does that mean, right? How does that work? When you inflate the money supply, when you print more without producing anything, when you simply click the button and you create out of thin air, those that are the furthest from this button clicking lose the most. This is called the Cantillon effect. It's this effect that whoever is closest to the money printer loses the least, or even benefits, if you think about it, from that influx of money supply. A very easy way to describe it is, let's say that we're all playing Monopoly, and at some point one of us goes to the kitchen, gets himself a cup of tea, and coming back, they simply bring another box of Monopoly with them, and they use all of that money that was in the second box and put it into our game. What did that do is they, as the ones that effectively got money out of thin air and are able to spend it on things that actually matter, for example, you know, to buy a hotel on one of the streets, they benefit. And then each and every one of us who had some savings in this Monopoly money already, you know, either in our pockets or on the board, all of that money is worth less because suddenly it became a smaller part of the big whole. And this is what you're experiencing when you see the prices of, things at a shop go up. It's not that those things became more valuable, more expensive. It's that your money lost value. And if you've kept money in your pocket, you know, let's say that you keep £100 in your pocket over a year, if inflation is at 4%, by the end of that year, that £100 can only buy you an equivalent of £96, right? So you've not lost in quantity, you've lost in quality. It's a currency debasement. You're debasing the currency. You're making it less valuable. And of course, it's a subtle form of taxation, subtle form of theft, because you don't pay anyone anything. They simply take away some energy from that store of value, store of energy that you have, and, you know, use it for their benefits. You know, so these are the things that happen when the money supply expands. Asset holders, so people who have stocks, real estate, things that cannot be printed per se, they benefit. Wage earners and savers will fall behind because wages don't meet the inflation as fast. And wealth inequality widens over time. This is exactly what Paul was exploring with us on the other episode. Now, the problem with this and how difficult it is for us to notice and how frustrating it is for us once you do is that prices in the shop rise faster than your wage. And inflation, because of all the different ways in which data can be skewed and manipulated and sort of half truly told, you don't know until looking in retrospect just how much real inflation there was in any given year. And so if you are earning a wage, let's say that you earn £20,000 in a year, by the end of that year, maybe you're offered a raise of 4%, which is great, well done. But if in that same year inflation was 6%, next year you're effectively earning 2% less in quality, in value terms, than the year before. I mean, Yeah, it is, exactly. It's so bad. You know, I've had a situation recently where I heard one of my really, really important people in my life say that they've gotten a raise, and the raise is going to be 1.5, I think, percent. And they got a promotion and a raise. And I asked, what's the level of inflation in your country, because they live abroad? And I mean, they didn't check it. I didn't want to bother them further, but for me it's outrageous, right? If it is I believe that if you do a good job, and if someone is giving you a raise, if someone is giving you a promotion, then the least they can do is they can make sure that you're earning as much in value terms as before. And one could argue that even more, right? Like if my efforts this year, let's say that, you know, I've been doing this podcast for almost 5 years now. I believe that I'm better at it now than I was before. And hopefully, if all things, go the right way, in 5 years' time, I will be better yet than I am right now. Naturally, I would expect whoever is paying me, if I was a wage earner for this show, naturally, I would expect them to be paying me more this year than 5 years ago, simply because my skills have, improved. And this is not to make you feel disappointed with your raise, but it is for you to question, because this is a very valid argument. And I'm pretty sure that if you are in a situation like my friend, where maybe you were offered a raise and you realize that raise does not meet the inflation in the country, take action, make it known to them. I wouldn't be surprised if your boss, if the company agrees with you and pays you that additional simply because they might not know it either. You know, this is the absurd part of this whole inflation scheme that not only is it quite difficult to see it in real time until looking retrospectively, but also on top of that, people simply don't notice, don't understand. We are led to believe that it's completely normal and it's healthy, and therefore maybe your boss doesn't know it either, you know? So the problem here, and this is the controversial point, I think, that Lynn makes in her book, which is the system is not failing, it is operating according to its design constraints. This system isn't broken. It's exactly as it should be by its design. There is this idea I've quoted quite a few times already. The point of a system is what it does, right? If, just before I go into that, and I know it might be a little bit uncomfortable for you to perceive this, but people often think that inflation is due to policy mistakes, due to, you know, the government that doesn't do things well, or people not understanding economics, whatever, the capitalists are being bad, whatever. Inflation is not a policy mistake. It is a part of the system. People think that inequality are due to unintended consequences, that inequality, this growing gap between haves and have-nots, those that have assets and those that don't, is widening because of some magical, you know, unintended consequence scenario. It is a part of the system yet again. It's not a bug, it's a feature. People think that currency debasement is due to mismanagement. If inflation is a part and parcel of the system, if nothing stops this train, then it is a part of the system to debase the currency. Maybe at a slower rate, maybe at a faster rate, but it is a part of it. So to understand this, it might be slightly infuriating for you, but if the system requires continuous, you know, credit expansion and asset inflation and currency dilution, then wealth concentration isn't accidental, inflation isn't temporary, and intervention isn't optional. There is no way to stop this train the way it's going unless we would stop the system. And of course, this is not for us to do. So, you know, maybe it's worth your while to think about it. No? So the question, of course, you know, you might think like, how do we fix the system? And instead of that question, I would argue, do we need a different system, right? Entirely. And this is the part that I've had a discussion with my friend recently, that from my perspective, it's fundamentally designed this way. So are we trying to repair something that is fundamentally designed a certain way? How can we repair it as part of the system? Maybe this is not exactly what can be done, right? Now, I know I've spilled a lot of information on you, and I know I've not given as much dues to the work of Lynn as I could. I hope to be able to discuss it with her in more depth into the future. But for you, my dear listener, since you've been with me this far, and maybe you're waiting for a set of ideas to act upon, right? I'll give you three questions, and then we'll explore what can we do about it. So the first question is, if nothing stops this train, what does winning actually look like? Secondly, if money is a technology, who should control its evolution? And third one, if inflation is a hidden tax, who is really paying it and who benefits? Now, of course, the second and the third, we sort of alluded to, in terms of the control of money as money as technology and evolution. Of course, no one's really controlling it. It's the market that controls it to the degree that people, if all of us today would decide that we're no longer using dollars as money, then dollars would not be money anymore, because you need the participants in the market to see something as money and to use it as money for it to be money, right? Now, if inflation is hidden tax and who's, you know, who's really paying it, who benefits, of course, if you have been paying attention, effectively everyone pays it unless they don't store any of their value, any of their time, any of their energy in the currency that is being debased. And, you know, for this reason, for example, maybe, you know, some of you might not want to keep your savings in dollars, in pounds, in euros. Maybe you want to put them into something that cannot be printed, right? And I don't really, you know, this is no financial advice. I'm not going to be giving you guidelines how to do it. But there are assets out there, some smaller, some bigger, that allowed people through history to keep the store of their value intact, or at least to minimize the losses. For example, we know that gold inflates per year roughly 2%. This is due to the constant digging out of more gold. But, you know, it's 2%, while inflation might be 4% in any given year. And if you think about the fact that gold might actually be quite a... might actually be inversely correlated to inflation of currency in which it is priced, you could argue that actually that inflation of 2% in gold is actually much better for you to choose than inflation of 6% in dollars. And so maybe you buy some gold instead of keeping all your savings in dollars. Of course, people buy houses or, you know, some collectibles. Some people hold Bitcoin, some people hold commodities. You know, I bet there are quite a few people out there who, due to trading in oil before the crisis, are benefiting from it, right? This, while you are paying higher gas prices, someone else is benefiting from that price increase, right? So to answer this first question, if nothing stops this train, what does winning actually look like? I would argue you can educate yourself. And by educating yourself and taking skillful action, learning about investing and saving and understanding what money really is and what are the options for you to choose from, you can in many ways become immune to it. Not fully, you know, you still have to pay taxes, and that's, I don't think that's going to change, but you can minimize your losses, right? You can hedge your bets, as they say. And this is something that, you know, I would urge you to do wholeheartedly. It did make my life much easier to understand these things. And these are not complicated things. Some of the things in this book are complicated, but the gist of it, the point of it, is very, very straightforward. If the system must expand, if money keeps evolving, and if the costs are evenly distributed, then the real question really is whether change is coming, right? And isn't really whether change is coming. It's who will benefit and who will be left behind, right? If that's how it's going to be, unless something changes, I don't know. Who knows? Change is always a constant in life. The question is, on which side are you going to be? And this is no like conflict sides. It's more choosing, as from the scripture, you might remember, to build your house on a rock and not on sand, right? If you haven't thought about your future in terms of your savings and investments, now is the time. The future is coming regardless. The past is in the past. You have only the present, and in the present you're constantly acting. But if you act, you know, skillfully, if you take some educational steps, and if you take some action, if you save some and invest some, you might find that in the future, your time and energy will be secure and better spent and saved, right? And I wish for you, as I wish for myself, as I wish for my wife, as I wish for all my friends and everyone in the world, really, to get to that stage of financial, you know, independence, financial security, financial freedom, whatever you want to call it, that you're no longer reliant on constantly chasing your own tail and making the ends meet. And if that's how you've been living so far, let this episode be a kick up your butt to change it. Because you can. You can, 100%. I have no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. And I'll see you there. Now, in terms of the invitation for this week, I could challenge you with, you know, having to read this as an invitation. But I won't. I know that for a week, even for myself, this book was quite a hefty one, and a week was not enough. But let's put it this way, because this is one of the more complex and one of the final episodes of this season. The invitation for this week for you is to think which aspect of this idea that I've broken down for you, hopefully well enough, which aspect sounds most curious, most interesting for you, and simply look up ways to educate yourself about it. It can be, you know, maybe getting one of the books that we've explored earlier, maybe listening to one of the episodes that we've explored earlier, maybe discussing with someone who knows about it, maybe simply Googling it, maybe talking to your, you know, personal assistant AI or whatever. But start educating yourself. Take action. This is the time. As we're going into this, you know, I would say, or as we're going through this sort of a crisis in the world in many ways, some will lose and some will get left behind, but some will be okay because they will know what to do. And I would like you to be in that group. So I wish that for you. Other than that, please make sure to, yet again, subscribe, like, send it to a friend. Let me know in the comments below or in an email what do you think. And yeah, have a wonderful, wonderful week. Stay happy, stay healthy, and I'll see you next time.